To study the literature and writings from other cultures and people serves only to enhance an understanding of ourselves as people. And translation studies tells us that the act of translating texts from one language to another is part of the historical process.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with University of Arizona professor Christina Devereaux Ramirez about her book, Occupying Our Space, The Mestiza Rhetorics of Mexican Women, Journalists and Activists, 1875 to 1942, published by the University of Arizona Press.
Occupying Our Space is a feminist rhetorical recovery project that attempts to answer the question of which Mexican women journalists and activists were at the forefront of claiming a discursive puesto, or a public space, and how they sometimes succeeded and many times failed.
Occupying Our Space with Christina Devereaux Ramirez on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with Christina Devereaux Ramirez as we fill a gap in feminine rhetorical history by providing an in-depth look at several important Mexican journalists who claimed rhetorical puestos, or public speaking spaces.
Some of these women included Laurena Wright de Kleinhans, Juana Belén Gutiérrez de Mendoza, and Ermila Galindo.
In the book, Ramirez sheds new light on the contributions of Mexican women journalists and activists during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, marked as the zenith of Mexican journalism.
These women were pioneers and revolutionaries who broke social mores and claimed a discursive space for women's voices, which would gain greater dominance through the 20th century.
Professor, rhetorician, researcher, and writer Christina Ramirez, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Brad.
So the book's title is a translation of the phrase...
Ocupando nuestro puesto means occupying our space. And I took this phrase from Juana Belén Gutiérrez de Mendoza.
Salías del templo un día, llorona, cuando al pasar yo te vi.
In 1903, she was writing and running in circles of this pre-revolutionary activism there in Mexico City, which was the hub of this revolutionary action. In 1903, in May, she published in her newspaper called Vesper, Justicia Libertad, this kind of radical protest piece. Una vez más, Vesper viene a ocupar su puesto. Once again, Vesper returns to occupy its post in the field of combat. Vesper no ha querido luchar solo para un cambio. Vesper has not wanted to fight for just a change of personnel in the public administration. And she calls to the people of Mexico saying, help us. The journalists are being silenced. We're being thrown in jail. Estamos aquí a ocupar nuestro puesto. She says that we're here to occupy our space. But in that calling, she's saying that they are here to claim a feminist space in Mexico.
These are rhetorics of Mexican women journalists and activists, 1875 to 1942. Why that span of time?
1875 was the beginning of the presidential reign of Porfirio Díaz, and he would be president for the next 30 years. He did a lot for Mexico. Mexicans to this day don't necessarily see him as the bad president, the evil dictator. They see him as having done a great deal for Mexico, having brought the Industrial Revolution to Mexico. The train system running through Mexico. So this time in Mexico, 1900, it was kind of the beginning of the end of the peaceful era from 1875 to 1900, because that's when you had the revolutionary voices of the Flores Magón brothers. And they were protesting selling off the lands to Americans and Europeans. And so you had this emergence of a protest in Mexico leading up to the ousting of Porfirio Díaz in 1910 and the eruption of the Mexican Revolution, November 20th, 1910. That's when it marked the beginning of the revolution.
So what interested you in this project?
Well, this goes back to the time right before I started the PhD program at the University of Texas at El Paso in rhetoric and writing studies. The summer before my entering into the program, I had this crazy idea that I was going to write a novel in 3 months. And this novel was to be based on Chicana identities in the States. One of my main characters was to have been an Adelita. And the Adelitas at the time during the Mexican Revolution were the soldaderas. That was their nickname. A lot of them followed their husbands out onto the battlefield. They were cooks. They were nurses. Many of them did pick up arms, but they served a pivotal role in the Mexican Revolution. As I began my book, which I never finished, and maybe now I should, I realized that I knew very little about the soldaderas. So I went back to the library, and I found a book by Charlene Soto, The Emergence of the Modern Mexican Woman and Her Role in the Mexican Revolution. I checked it out, and that night, I inhaled the book. At the end of each chapter, Charlene Soto dedicates 2 to 3 pages, maybe, on the activism of female journalists. And that's where I first was introduced to Laurena Wright de Kleinhans. And that was it. I had been taken.
Tell us about Laurena Wright de Kleinhans.
Laurena Wright de Kleinhans was born in 1842 in Mexico City to an American father and a Mexican mother. So she was living the mestizaje early on in Mexico. Te reclamo mis derechos naturales para poder cuidar. I demand of you my natural rights to be able to take care of myself and of my main duties. Conozco el lugar que debo. I know the place that I should occupy. Laurena Wright de Kleinhans was a privileged Mexican elite. And so she received really a very prominent education. She was very lucky at that time in Mexico to have received such an education because illiteracy was very high and not very many women were receiving this kind of education, partly because she also had American connections with her father. But early on, she started writing and was a poet. And one of her early poems, Dios, was picked up on the poet circuit there in the Lyceums and was very well received. And she was accepted into many of the poetic Lyceums that women were not allowed into, which was a very rare occurrence. In the 1880s, she realized the importance for women to have a place and a public venue from which to speak. And so in her position, in her puesto as literary editor of Las Hijas de la Nahuac, she invites the women from all over Mexico to send in their poetry, to send in their writings, and to not be afraid. Yo no soy la esclava. I am not a slave, sino la conductora de la humanidad. But rather a guide for humanity. And so this was really an emergence of literacy and rhetorical education.
From Irina Wright Yukonhas, what did you learn about her work?
One of the things that I learned about Laurena Wright de Kleinhans is that she was not living in a time where she could really push the boundaries. She still had to stay within the social structure, the social mores of femininity at the time. And you can see this arising in her journal. While at one point they're calling for women to become educated, to become worldly, they're reporting on what women are doing all over the world, in the United States, in Europe, and beyond. Then on the next pages of this Proclamation of Independence, you have them talking about how important it is to be a mother and to stay at home. So there was this real feminine kind of conundrum they were in. They were right at the cusp of claiming this feminism, but they just weren't there. So Laureana was really at that cusp. She wrote what I call one of the first feminist treaties of the time.
Irreverentemente dirige su cordial saludo a todas las clases de la sociedad, a la prensa, de todos los matices políticos y a los hombres del poder y del Estado.
And you can see resonance of this treaty in other women's writings at the turn of the century. They knew about each other. Juana Belén knew about Laurena Wright de Kleinhans.
This is Arts and Letters, and we're talking with Cristina Ramirez about the mestiza rhetorics of Mexican women journalists and activists, 1875 to 1942. Tell us about Doña Juana. She was poor, barely had a third grade education, mm-hmm. but was really speaking for the masses.
Now, Juana, she was the rebel. She was the no holds barred, I'm here, don't mess with me.
Tenemos un indiscutible derecho a no desaparecer como raza.
We have an indisputable right to not disappear as a people.
We do not want to be a part of humankind as a conquered people, nor with the poor temperament of an assimilated people.
No reconocemos a ninguna raza. El derecho.
And we do not recognize the right of any people to impose their civilization on us.
We never wanted it this way. They made the rules that we must play. Maybe someday we'll be friends. But until then.
She was actually born in the same dusty pueblo, San Juan del Río Durango, that Pancho Villa was born in. She was born 1 year before Pancho Villa in this pueblo. And she was born into poverty.
And that would have been
1875. And this is why I write about Juana Belén, Doña Juana, and Laureana, to show the contrast. You've got the elite voice, and then you have a more grassroots organic intellectual that I like to call Doña Juana. There's a great story when her husband dies of complications from miner's lung. She moves to Guanajuato, Mexico. And she takes her children and her goat, Sancha, and starts her newspaper, Vesper Justicia Libertad. And early on, she realizes because of its success, she needs more money for ink and materials to publish her journal. And she has to sell her goat, Sancha. There's this moment where she's hugging her goat, Sancha, and crying and wishing she could return to the mountains of Durango, her homeland. But she understands that she has this calling to write for and with the people of Mexico. Her La Raza. It's like that understanding moment of who you are in this life. And she knew that she had to write. El derecho de imponernos su civilización. Our aspirations and our salvation are not in becoming incorporated into another civilization, but in restoring our own. Sino restaurar la nuestra.
And in her writing, she pleads with people about their rights of free speech while people were just standing around in silence watching what was happening with
Porfirio Diaz.
And so she's fighting the man.
She was thrown in jail many times because at that time there was a distinction between prisons. Women a lot of times would be locked into the convents. For whatever reasons. But she was thrown into a prison called Belen Prison, where they housed the male journalists. And so that also is very indicative of her occupying this space of resistance there in jail.
She says, for this reason, we accuse you, and for this reason, we have come to claim your place.
Yes, she has come to claim the space of women speaking. That was her puesto, her calling to speak to the Mexican people and to claim that space. I had to be careful in writing this that I wasn't stepping in a place of essentializing these women. And because of my position as a Mexican-American, as a Chicana, I was careful in my writing. I pulled a lot from Krista Radcliffe's rhetorical listening in this. And a part in my book, I slow down and I write about this rhetorical listening and what it means to listen to those that are from other cultures or have differing identities than our own. But because I identify with that, I have family that came from Mexico, but now I'm here in the States occupying this place. Bury me down in your heart.
That's where I began to dig my grave. And also, yeah. You reconnected with your grandmother's work.
When you write history, you have to position yourself within that history as well, because history is a telling or a retelling of stories. And you are, in many ways, also woven into this history. And where your skin begins, mine ends, mine ends, mine ends. And when you write history, you come to an understanding of the people that you are writing about, but I also absolutely believe that you come to an understanding also of yourself. My grandmother, born in 1906 in El Paso, Texas, right along the border, she grew up in a barrio called Chihuahuita. She, later in her life, was a writer. She was writing down the stories and histories of what she remembered growing up at the turn of the century there in El Paso in Chihuahuita. And she's a Chicana published writer. She published her works in 1973 from Quinto Sol, a journal out of Berkeley, California, titled Chicanas en la Literatura y el Arte. And she had 5 of her short stories published. Escribió en español. My grandmother was writing in Spanish. And when I moved in with her at the age of 19, she was 85. I was ignorant of this fact that she was a published Chicana writer. And as I was writing these histories of these Mexican women writers, I found her writings. We've recovered actually 250 pages of her writings and understood maybe the struggles that my grandmother went through to get an education, to become a writer, to get her works published. And so, yes, in writing about these Mexican women, I came to a better understanding of who my grandmother was, and eventually my own identity, also as a mestiza and a Chicana writer.
This is Arts and Letters, and we're talking with Cristina Ramirez about the mestiza rhetorics of Mexican women journalists and activists, 1875 to 1942. You also suggest that mestiza rhetoric offers a way to filter the complexities and contradictions that arise in Mexican women's writings.
The mestizo or mestiza lens, it resides in this perpetual space of hybrid paradoxes. You're constantly going between these two identities, and it resists assimilation to one or the other half. And it becomes this real complex negotiation when one is trying to articulate a construct of identity. It's a balancing act that is never easy. But for me, it became this lens to look at what the women were doing. They were enacting this mestizaje. For example, Ermila Galindo. We haven't spoken about her. Ermila Galindo, she's the last woman that I talk about.
And this is around 1950.
Her writings did come right at the beginning of the revolution. She was also born in Durango. And she wasn't necessarily an elite like Laureana. But she wasn't a grassroots, organic intellectual like Juana either. She was more of this emerging middle class, and she received an early kind of technical education, kind of cutting edge at that time, learning how to be a typist and even like a court reporter. And she got her big break when she was actually participating in these political clubs in Mexico during the revolution. And they asked her to give the speech for Presidente Carranza. He was now the president of Mexico. and he was going to march into Mexico City as the constitutional president. And she gives this very eloquent speech praising President Carranza. And he was impressed. He was really impressed with her oratory skills and offered her a position as spokeswoman for President Carranza. And this was very interesting. At this time, there was a lot of feminist activity in Latin America, in South America, and also as well here in the States. And President Carranza obviously was hearing these voices, and he wanted to be really seen as that progressive president that was accepting of women. So he pretty much gave Ermila Galindo free rein to travel around the country, to start these clubs, and to speak. She was given the podium to articulate her feminist concept of the Mexican woman.
And she even traveled to Cuba.
She writes about it in her book, La Doctrina Carranza y el Acercamiento Indolatino. And so she goes to Cuba, and she first is able to speak to a group of Cuban women. And she greeted the Cuban people with what today would sound like this very kind of melodramatic, high language speech. And she says, Adzum, Adzum, si, heme aquí, heme aquí. Yes, I am here. I am here at last at your side. I am here with you ladies, and me, the modest female writer, the burning, inveterate bohemian of Aztec blood. So she understands her dual identity and uses that in her speeches. It's absolute rhetorical strategy to really embrace the women that she's speaking to, that we come from this indigenous background. And so it's a form of commonality and identification that she has with her audience.
Pushing back against the concept of manifest destiny.
Yes, of this American imperialism. And what a place to talk about it in Cuba.
So although the women journalists you study came from a variety of social, political backgrounds, they're connected.
Down to the very root of it, they're connecting in wanting to claim a space, to claim their puesto, because they didn't have that place from which to speak. They'd been relegated to the kitchen. They had been relegated to the laundry room. To the nursery. And they wanted to claim a different space. They loved their nation of Mexico. They were hijas de Anahuac. They were daughters of this race. And they wanted to participate in this coming to being of Mexican women.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters, Ringo Starr, and Amy Jo Savanna. We'd also like to thank Stephen Wells of Birthday Club for writing and producing the score for this episode, featuring the incredible vocal talents of Elizabeth Salazar Rodriguez. Thanks to Mr. Chris Hickey, who recorded the show. Thank you to intern Krista Hancock. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for all you do for our Arts and Letters team. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer and rhetorician Christina Devereaux Ramirez, whose book recovers and revivifies the essential spaces occupied by Lauren Wright de Kleinhans, Doña Juana, and Emilia Gallindo, whose passionate, brave, and truthful voices are essential blueprints for all of us. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Frida Kahlo. Feet, what do I need you for when I have wings to fly?